So, hello everyone to today's programming languages. Last time we have finished with the chapter of concurrency, so today is going to be a slightly different topic from compared to what we had before. So this is about dispatching method calls. So what is it that we are going to see today? So first of all, we will introduce a little bit how dispatching can be observed in the wild out there. We will set up some kind of formal model for that, and we're gonna see how far we have actually understood how these methods, and have a more inside look into what's happening in there. We will focus first on the matter of single dispatching, and further on we will progress to the matter of multi-dispatching, where we look at a few examples where multiple dispatching is applied. So let's dive right in, and we're gonna go through that in a kind of a chronological way, starting with the direct function calls that were there in the beginning of time, so to say, for us. So let's start with the basics of C here. So in the old days, when we had the ancient versions of C around, kind of the most complex thing that we could do with functions was things like the ones that you see over here, where we declared functions. Declared functions with their static signature, with a return type and parameter types, and could do several of those, like fun and bar here, and you would usually not only be able to keep them apart by their signature, mean parameter types and return types, but also particularly with their name. So for each method that you or function that you introduced, you had to use a new name, and kind of the most sophisticated thing that you could do was having pointers to functions and pass them around during your code, transporting certain entry points around through your program. So one step more in the direction of more complex behaviors is introducing overloading of function names, which means that you would want to have things similar to this example here, where you have one common name but several signatures introduced for that. And if you tried that with your kind of ancient compilers, then declaring functions with functions with the same names but different parameters was a thing that was not legal in that sense. So fast forward a few years, what people have come up with then was some kind of patch for that by extending the basic grammar with a particular keyword that would help you in doing static disambiguation between types. This would enable the piece of code that we have seen so far, which was this thing over here, to actually compile with a bit of trickery behind, like what you see over here, where you would define your desired function name like this, and this would work internally by calling another macro, which would fork based on the static type of the expression that it is parameterized with. So this thing would branch to either of the cases that you see over here, this one or this one, depending on the actual static type of the expression from over here as a parameter, and you could give the appropriate types on which you would like to dispatch as these parts over here. So that is kind of the fix for that that was introduced in 2011. So this is the expression part. This is the type name part. I think this is what I used for the expression over here, and the generic association list, I think, is what is expanded anyway by that. So that is kind of the way that I have highlighted that in code. Maybe also this generic keyword, that is this one from over here. So that is kind of the way that this fraction of the grammar would actually work. So this introduced some way of being able to do case distinction between static types of expression that appear in there. All in all, you might decide for yourself whether you find that a nice approach or not. That is how it's actually done. But maybe moving on to a little bit more recent languages, you have a concept of overloading function names in a more maybe accessible way than the one that you have seen me that you have seen sketched on the slide before. So this is usually how, well, in this case it's Java code, but I think it's not so different throughout all these kind of higher level languages like C#, C++, Java, or whatever you might want to take from that. So there's the idea of introducing one name and having several different versions of methods offered for that particular name, differentiated between each other by just different signatures. And you can see them in action in the piece of code over here, where you see that the function f is once called with an expression that has the compile time type int, and on the other side you see the one with a compile time type, well, something compatible with double. So what you would see the compiler do is, well, dispatch it once in the int version, leading to this one over here, and once for the double version, dispatching over here. Well, so far that might be still quite simple for your cases. Let's have a look at how that behaves if you introduce things like inheritance in your code. So now you see that the name f is now mentioned throughout several places in the code, in class B and class D, and we have the same calls as we had before in our example, so this hasn't changed. So depending now on the kind of school that you've been through, you might now tend to answer what is seen on the output a little bit differently. So what would you expect to see in the output? Same output as before? Everyone agrees with that? Yeah? Like this? Is there anyone who doesn't like to see it like this? Sorry? Like this? So that's actually where the Java and the C++ route diverge. So if you place your overloaded buffers in different places throughout your inheritance relation, depending on which language concept you're following, this is actually treated differently. So maybe if you would have expected something like this, what would you have to do in order to make it behave like the Java version? What would you want to cast to int? Which part? And would that help? Well, what you, for example, can do is explicitly tell the system to actually import the name into your new scope. So that's why there's this each and every lecture. There's this concept of scopes here. So if you have different scopes and you find an appropriate matching candidate here, you stop in your search in the C++, except for if you explicitly imported the version from the former scope into your actual scope. So, yeah. Depending on the school that you've gone through, whether you've started with C++ or Java, you might find one more comfortable than the other one. But, well, you should maybe at least be aware of that there's actual differences in what you should expect from running that code. So there's differences in implementing that. Also, you might run into hassles with overloading. Well, originally I was going to ask whether you could imagine any problems running into, but the code maybe already gives you a lot of hints what might go wrong in these situations. So, would you mind explaining that to me? So this is perfectly fine, the example over here, everything. So the thing is that with this one over here, you get two integers as parameters, and now you have the choice which function to match that with. So there's two candidates over here, and, well, what principle is there to tell you which of the potential candidates is the right one? So both of them are somewhat more specific than the other one. First match. If there is such a rule, then maybe. If not, then we get something like this. So there, you can run into ambiguous references to methods, and these are due to the system not knowing which of the candidates to dispatch to. So you could introduce things like priority rules in the sense that the first overrules the second parameter, for example, but some languages might argue in the direction of, well, you want to keep your users from running into unexpected problems due to these ambiguous definitions by just not having such a rule and explicitly telling you that this is ambiguous, for example. So, yeah, that is something that starts being an issue when you start with overloading your method. So, what is happening in the background of that? What is the general concept of dispatching in presence of overloading? Well, that is what, first of all, the static dispatching is all about. So, so far we haven't had anything dynamic in there, so implicitly everything was considered to be static, so that's why we're talking about static dispatching over here. So, you have the situation that you find as a compiler, you find yourself confronted with the programmer writing down a particular expression which the programmer intends to be a function call and needs to be dispatched to whatever the user meant with this expression. On the other side, you have a collection of function definitions that could be possible dispatching targets in that sense. So these are methods specified with their complete interface, so their signature, and you as the compiler now have the problem to somehow find a connection between the expression that is formulated on one side in red here and a collection of given signatures that might be candidates for dispatching to based on their names, for example. So what happens in order to create a relation between them is that the compiler does what he always does. It determines the static types of all the expressions involved in this function call expression. From there, it derives the static signature of the call expression. So that is what is... I used blue here, so in order to refer to that, I maybe change that to green. So this leads to this static signature of the call expression in green. This gives you the static types of the return value, T0 prime, and all the static types of the parameters, starting from parameter 1 to parameter n, as types T1 to Tn prime. Then what you get is the collection of signatures, like all the function declarations that are visible in your scope. So now the problem is to find a function definition that is applicable in the case of the currently currently valid function call expression and its static type. And it's not even a question of whether the functions are just applicable to, because there might be several ones. The other thing is which one is the most specific one. And that is the one that's going to be chosen as the target to which to dispatch to. This is the notion of this overloading. And if you have a more specific parameter, for example, this rules out candidates that have more general types for that particular parameter. And if you have, several candidates that conflict with each other in being more special for one parameter or the other, then, this runs into the error that you've seen before, where there's where there's ambiguity. So the components are the function call expression, the function which needs to be dispatched. Then there's the static types of parameters and the function name, which play a role. And then there are the concrete methods that are potential targets for this method call. And this is matched via the signature. And Well, you can determine whether they are applicable to each other if there is a particular relation holding between, particularly the subtype relation. So the function call candidate needs to be a subtype of the function calls signature. And what does that mean? Well, the subtype relation, in that sense, if you, well, maybe if you have attended compiler construction, you might remember what subtype relations are all about and how they translate to things like function types. So what you particularly need in order for that to hold between each other is that the return type of the calling of the potential callee is a subtype of the return type necessary for the function call expression, as well as the parameters of the calls. Static types need to be subtypes of the types of the candidates. So you notice that in the parameters, the subtype relation changes compared to before. So conceptually, they kind of switch places with each other compared to the way that the subtype relation was between the functions, which is also called contravariance. So that is how you would have to read that. And yeah, thus, if the if a candidate is a subtype to the candidate's signature is a subtype to the signature of the call expression, it is actually applicable. And then you need to kind of find the minimum with respect to the subtype relation in order to find the acceptable or the candidate to which to dispatch to. If there's not a unique minimum that you can find, then it's ambiguous. So that is what statical dispatching is all about. If you look into what, for example, the Java C compiler does, well, you can do so since it's open source, so let's have a look in there. And it's actually reflecting what we have seen in this more type theoretic view, in the sense that it has a notion of something being applicable to something else, as well as a concept of something being more specific than something else. And if you look at particularly the methods, they are there is more specific than something else is mapped to, well, covariantly to the is more specific property on the return types, which is this more type and less type that you could obtain through this get type things. And contravariantly on the is applicable relation between the argument types. So there you see the less type is moving to the first operand compared to where it has been before. So this reflects this this notion of contravariance and is more specific being implemented that way. So that is the way that inside the Java C the whole thing is talking about relations between types. And well, what the compiler does during its compilation phase, so that is the static phase of the analysis of the code, is that it tries to find the most specific concrete method for a particular call expression, and that is what this match method function does inside the Java C compiler. And well, there's a lot of code in there. Basically, I can give you kind of an outline of what happens there, but if you're really interested in that, you might look into the sources yourself. So there's a variable tentative where you keep your most probable candidate for dispatching to, and in general, a list of other methods which might also look as like possible maximally specific candidates too. This is the case where you find that there's ambiguities and you might want to collect information about which of the definitions that are there are possibly conflicting with each other. So that's why you keep this candidate list in there. So apart from that, what you do is you go through all the possible member definitions that you find, store them in methods, and look up for the method name. You obtain them by looking up the method name in all methods, and then first of all check if they are applicable at all. So checking that basically there is a subtype relation between the candidate from method and the call expression that got already analyzed for its argument types. And if that is the case, well, the access code, I think we're going to skip. This is not interesting for us right now. If there's no candidate so far that has proven to be applicable, then you've got your new candidate right here and store it as the tentative dispatching target. And if not, then, well, you turn your comparison around and check whether the so far found candidate is more specific than your currently found thing, and then you decide whether you keep the other one or throw it away, or even find an ambiguous situation where you need to add to the candidate list, and then that's what you find over there. So all in all, as a summary, what you do is you gather all information that's statically available, accumulating in the static type of the call expression, then check what is present in your scope in terms of function name, whether it's applicable to your method call, and then which of the alternatives that you are given is actually applicable. Is actually most specific with respect to your call expression. That is what static dispatching is all about. This is now complicated by the matter of overriding methods, which is kind of the next feature that builds upon that. So this comes into the game by the idea of object-oriented languages. And in object-oriented languages, one of the key principles that kind of determines the general view on things is that in these object-oriented systems, usually you stress one of the object that is involved with a message. That's already small talk syntax with a method call quite prominently, and this one is called the receiver, and is extracted from the so far not further distinguished parameters and pulled in front of the method name and separated with the method name with a dot. So that is, if you have been raised with things like Java or C++, you might know that. This dates back to the time from Smalltalk and has been introduced there and was kind of the key concept for this kind of view. So instead of formulating your object type as this class thing, which is pretty much similar to what an ordinary structure or record looks like, and contributing methods to this thing. Turns out, or turned out, a common pattern was that you usually had particular functions that would always work on a particular data structure, like the naturals over here, and would thus be always used as the first parameter for that, and then used within the function. So you would naturally also have to call these methods always with an accompanying base data structure. And in these object-oriented languages, usually you would consider that there's always a data structure which you would refer to in these functions, and then go over to call these functions methods, and implicitly consider some kind of object data structure associated with that, thus making the transition to the method over here, where you implicitly emanate from the idea that this is always considered to be somewhat in relation to base data structure. In our example here, this inkby would be always considered to be in relation to the natural, or an object of type natural. And implicitly, you can access everything that comes with that data structure via this thing. And of course, also for the method call, you would have to provide what has been a first parameter, but now prominently keep that in front of the method call, separated only via this dot operator. So all these object-oriented languages can be seen as kind of a special case of the general method call, which kind of prominently deal with syntactic sugar with the first parameter, making it implicit in specifying the methods. But underneath the hood, if you look into the implementations of all that, you see that if you realize that in machine code or intermediate code, you usually revert back to the original view, where the receiver parameter is once again made explicit as the first parameter. So, so the key concept that came with that was now that you not only could introduce some kind of incremental specification of data types with the concept of subtyping, but you would also introduce the idea of dynamically overriding the implementation of a particular method name and signature. What that means in our example is, so we have a class integral now and a subclass natural that extends integral. So this is this kind of extension specification that we have, and what we allow here is that the method within natural, if it matches the method from integral, then there it is considered to be overridden for whenever we have an object of type natural as the dynamic type of a particular expression. What that means in terms of execution in an example is what we see over here. So there's this integral that, well, I tried to save space and didn't keep the constructors on there, but you can imagine how the constructors look like. They just take an integer number and put it in there. So there's an integral I that is created over here, and if you call the increment by 42 here, then well, there's nothing too special happening here. There's just one dispatching target that makes sense, which is this ink by, and you would assume that this one is called. Of course, you can do the same thing for the natural. So you could create a natural, and if you call the ink by on the natural, then of course this dispatches over here. The kind of new thing that came with object orientation now was that if you propagate the values within that you created within statical type of natural around your program, you would also be allowed to propagate that to variables originally only intended to be typed with integral, or aka the base type, parent type of your class. So you could keep an object of type n within a variable designated for just integral, and by doing so and calling ink by, although locally for this expression over here, the static types look the same way as they have been looking over here, the call would actually dispatch to the same version that we have seen in the specialized code over here. So that is kind of the basic principle for polymorphic calls, or dynamic resolution of method calls, whatever you might want to call that. And that was what made object orientation special in that sense. So what does that mean for our concept that we have set up in the slides before? So this is now about dynamical dispatch. So the part for static dispatching is the one that you see over here, and this one is still valid. Although we have dynamic dispatching, the compiler in that sense does not change. Everything that is done during compilation, this static analysis of a call expression, is still happening in case of dynamic dispatch. So there's still the static signature being determined, there's still the list of visible method candidates analyzed for the most specific dispatching target. What now is added to the system is a notion of the runtime, where we add the concept of being able to specialize what method is actually called. So you can't say at compile time anymore which address will be dispatched to. Instead, this is determined at runtime, based on the identity of the runtime type of the thing that in general you would call the first parameter, or the receiver parameter, this parameter, or this specific particular parameter which is emphasized in object orientation. And how can you actually implement something like that from a perspective of a compiler? And, as I've already mentioned, the old facilities for doing statical dispatching are still valid. So there is a static part of the dispatching still running and still working the same way as it has been before in, in the compiler of the in this case Java system, but now there's also something to be done by the runtime part. Speaking of the dynamic virtual machine for Java in that case, which is this dynamic hotspot, or just-in-time compiler interpreter depending on the way that you look at that. So let's have a look at how the code is evolving throughout its way from source code to the CPU. So this is kind of the code that you've seen in the examples before, where there's this integral variable I, so static type integral, which is assigned a value of, well, at that point, static type natural, but during its way in this variable, this would be the dynamic type of I. So there's a notion of a static type and a dynamic type. And then we find that there's the static compile time expression of I dot inc by 42. And if you analyze that with a static compiler, you will end up with the static signature of that, and this is reflected in what the Java Virtual Machine sees as its bytecode, particularly this bugger over here. Well, it's a little bit hidden in kind of several steps of analysis, but this hash 6, for example, resolves to a method signature, which is what you see here, integral dot inc by on an integer. And, well, this is considered to be the type of the expression to dispatch to. So you see that the static type of the whole thing, like the integral of the integral as the type of the receiver, has made all its way into the bytecode, and it needs to, because in dynamic dispatching you can't say statically what the actual dispatching target will be. So the question is now, how do we find our way to the to dispatch to the version of increment by that comes from natural? And this has to do with how the virtual machine or the runtime system treats this invoke virtual instruction. So let's have a look at that. And well, there's a whole lot of code which I don't expect you to really comprehend in all its beauty, but what it actually does is well, essentially, it will dispatch into this lookup implicit method. That is the kind of the core method that is used for resolving at runtime what the dispatch to method version will be, and it will get as the as parameters several things, particularly the resolved class and the resolved method. And what it will then do is it will dispatch to the lookup method on the class, which will essentially be a run through the super chain of class definitions. So in Java you have this organization of your types in terms of, well, you have always a reference to your super class via the super keyword, and this is reflected in the data structure that represents the type, so you can run on the list of parents by iterating on this super things. So what you do is then you run through this super chain, and on the way through this super chain, you will try to find a method that has a particular name and a signature. So what is actually dispatched to is now depending on how this find method actually works. So again, another piece of code. And this is essentially a binary search. through all the methods that are offered by this level of superclass over here, and well, you look for the whether the signature of the found method is exactly the same as the signature that you were given. So what you do there is a binary search on the exact signature of method that you were given, and the method the signature that you were given is the one that you obtained, well, through the invoke instruction, which was fed by the compiler. So you look for the type that the static phase of the compiler has analyzed, the static types of the parameters, not the ones that you actually found in the expression, but the ones that were associated with the method through search for most specific method that is visible in scope. And this type collection you now take during execution and look for an exact match in your type hierarchy, starting from the most specific class, going down step by step until you reach your base object. So for what is later on called single dispatching or dynamic dispatching, what you do is you have two components, one running in compile time in the compiler, which does static analysis using only statically available information, thus information available at compile time will determine the static type of the call expression. Look out for the most specific method currently visible to your at the position of your expression, and determine that as the signature. Then this is written out as your bytecode and taken at execution of your program by the runtime system, in this case the hotspot VM, and used in order to perform dynamic lookup of the most specific by the lookup, starting from the most specific place in the hierarchy of the at runtime present value, meaning the type of the of this value in the variable, going down step by step in more general direction until your lookup finds for the first time an appropriate candidate, and taking that as the dispatching target. So this looks fine. So what people who have not had such an in-depth view on that would then say, well, that's perfectly fine. I can now start using dynamic dispatching, and will write my code in a very convenient way. For example, we would consider that you would like to write your natural data type in a way that you would like to compare that to some other natural number by providing an equality method like the one over here, where you compare your natural to another one by just evaluating whether your internal data structures are the same, and well, be done with that. So well, one thing, ignore this part, you just obtain some kind of set implementation that is based on equality, not on the hash numbers over here. So if you then start using your code this way, with, well, putting your naturals into a set and printing out the content of your set, you might end up with your implementation giving you actually two naturals now, in your set, which would actually expect the whole thing to have, well, just one natural in there, because, well, both naturals based on zero should be the same. How's that? Is the set implementation buggy? Well, actually, what you need to do is you need to keep attention to your signature over here. What we have seen before is that it actually doesn't suffice to just provide an implementation or dispatching target that is special to whatever you want to express and hope that this is actually dispatched to. Particularly, you need to think about the conditions under which you want to actually call them. And what will happen is that inside the set method, this will boil down to comparison or to a call of equals with the expression being analyzed for what the most specific equals method is that can be seen, and this will decide to find the object variant of that, which is well per se fine. But the problem is that if you expect the whole system to dispatch to the natural thing, well, since at runtime you might actually specialize, and that's what actually done, but the parameter that is looked for is not the one from over here, but the one that was given in the static analysis phase, which is still object, thus this call is never dispatched to. So that might be kind of a hook for beginners in that sense. So since all of you have said that, well, you come from the Java side of education, you might be just not particularly challenged by the short quiz that I'm offering here for you in terms of dispatching. So here you go. Let's practice what we have learned so far. I'm sure you all know what will happen in that kind of code. So situation is you have two classes, A and B, each of them offering a particular collection of methods with maybe differing, maybe matching signatures, and some code that is expected to be executed with these two classes being visible. So first of all, what you get is variable B of static type B and a variable A of static type A. Both of them refer to the same actual object of type B, and then you get the actual call expression where now all the magic happens. So there's A dot M1 of B. M1. Don't feel ridiculed now. That's almost every time that I read the lecture the same thing. So I'm actually thankful that you have tried to answer, so don't feel ashamed there. How does that dispatch to M1A in A now? Maybe you?
The A variant is of type A, so we can look at class A for the M1 method.
So static type A for A can be read off from here. Static type of this one is B.
B,
So yeah, what you say with downcasting is this notion of finding the most specific thing that is there. In that sense, that still is applicable. So this notion of being applicable and more specific, but yeah, can be downcast is kind of similar to that. So the thing is, you look out for a static type of the receiver, being this one. So what is visible now to resolve dispatching a static target for that is, well, we need to check for M1. There's two options in there. You can't see this one over here. This one is only for calls on receiver of static type B. So this is discarded for an option to dispatch to. So instead, what is happening here is that we try to find a method that is applicable to the parameters here. We don't find a version that is specialized for B, but what we find is a version that is specialized for A. So this is the best one that we can get, the most specific that we can get. So this one is selected during the static dispatching phase. So static phase terminated. Now let's go over to dynamic phase. Dynamically, for A, we get that, well, A is fed from B and B is fed from this one. So the dynamic type is gonna be B for both of them. So this is what dynamic analysis gives us. It's determined by trying to catch the source for my object. So what we do now is we check at the actual dynamic type for the receiver, which is B, and look for an exact match of the static signature that we have determined on the run before. So we start where the green pointer is, looking for the signature determined in the red phase. So of course we will at first look at the method with the same name, which is this M1 thing, but now we have to compare whether it's an exact match with the signature that we have determined in the red phase, which, well, doesn't match for this one. So this can't be a candidate for dispatching to, although it would fit somehow. This is not how this whole system actually works. So instead, what's yes? It matches, but it's not an exact match. So it's compatible in the sense that it's well, it doesn't match in that sense, because you need to be able to answer calls that can have an A object in its parameter. And B is more No. This one is now. Keep in mind that this thing of what is the first parameter and what is not the first parameter is always kind of confused by this. By this pulling out the first parameter in front of everything else. So this thing here is not this first parameter from our diagram, but this one is. Okay, yeah. So yeah, this is not matching. It would need to be able to answer to calls that have an A type as parameter. So that can't be used for that. Instead, what we go through is the super type hierarchy and go to the next one that's there, which is the A thing, and there we find, yeah, well, there is one implementation over here, which is then chosen. And that is the key to doing the complete resolution of method calls in this setting. Do a static analysis of the types, determine the most specific thing that is visible with the current constraints, keep that in mind, and then switch over to the dynamic phase and scan your list for an exact match of that thing. Slightly different. So now what changes is static type of the B thing. So this one has a different... Sorry, that was not a clever thing to do. Static was red, wasn't it? So this thing changes now. So the static type is B now. And here the static type is... Oh no, this one is also B. So what is dispatch to? Well, we look into the system at B, find that M1 of B has now a match, so this one is visible, so this will most likely go to M1B in B. So that is kind of the difference between those two. So depending on what the static type of the receiver is, the whole thing changes. Dynamic types are irrelevant for that, because there is actually no overriding behavior between these two things, because their signature does not match. Instead, they are overloading each other, but that's another topic. So we might complicate that a little bit more by making things more indirect. So it's all about M2 in B. M2, is not resolved within B. So keep in mind, Java means that you can look at the supertypes things and look for variants over there. And, there is this thing, which is a likely candidate to dispatch to. So this will be dispatched to, but there it does not end. This thing over here. What is the static types of this one? For both of them, receiver and first parameter. So essentially, what we get here is implicitly this. This is always associated with whatever type is over there as static type, although the dynamic type is still considered to be the one over here, flowing into the system in this connection. So it's essentially boiling down to the same situation as we had in the first example. I was overly thinking because, there's still this M2 thing. So M2 with a parameter now. There is two names over here, which both have A as parameter. So there is an actual overriding connection between those two. So although this one dispatches over here in a statical point of view, since we have as a dynamic type AB, we will see that this one will be found first in the phase where we do the exact matching, because we could do an exact match due to this parameter being exactly the same one. So we will end up with M2 in A, and we can now change conditions a little bit by moving on to the M1 version over here, where now we have static and dynamic type of B directly here as parameters, but that changes the static types here to A, the static type here to B. So we look out for, the scope where to look for is A. There we look for M1 with parameter B. Can't find this directly, but the most specific candidate that we find is again this one. And that is taken as the static type or static signature of the method to dispatch to. So that's what we're going to do. And at runtime, although we start at B, we still have to look for this one. And, it's the same case as the first one, and we will reach this M1A in A. So that was the one where we have the same behavior as in the first case. So this should have made you a little bit more aware of what is actually happening in these. Oh, there's an M3, but I think that's just confusing you or trying to confuse you with this super thing, but that actually doesn't change a whole lot. So I think you'd be able to do that yourself. Yes? Yes. A is more general, yeah. And B is more specific. Yeah, for the simple types, there's also a notion of being more specific than something else, or being more general. So there is rules for that, depending on the programming language that you're. And this needs to be defined for these kinds of behaviors. But that depends on the type system of your language, but yeah, there should be these relations. So, now, multi-dispatching is actually the thing that would solve the problem that we have seen sketched on the example with the equals, where we wanted to specify equals for naturals with each other. That is as soon as you actually start the program with your with a call to your virtual machine with parameter your program, then the virtual machine starts running. Thus, the runtime system is up, and then the program is executed. And only at execution time, you know exactly what value will gonna be ending up at a particular call expression, and only then you can actually really determine what the actual runtime type of that thing will be. So the dynamic type will only be fixed then, and then you can start running through this chain. That depends on what your language specifies. So in the Java world, you will have everything dynamically dispatched, except you explicitly mention for it not to be, which can be done with a static keyword. In the C++ world, it's the other way around. You have to explicitly specify that method call is dispatched dynamically by the virtual keyword. So, depends on your language.
Okay, but it doesn't depend, for example, on stuff like the object stuff or like caustic stuff, so it's completely dependent either that...
You can statically... this is determined by the modifier that the static analysis of your call expressions type gives you. So, you look up the static type of the expression, find the most specific match statically, and then check in this definition whether it is virtually resolved or statically resolved. And this decides how you translate it, whether you use a virtual, an invoke virtual or an invoke static in the Java case. But yeah. Good. So, multi-dispatching now. This is. Taking it up from the mainstream languages, C++, Java, C#, Smalltalk, Lisp, whatever you might want to think, is tackling this problem that you run into when you try to program in situations similar to this equals problem, where you would like to specify your code particularly for very special types, but the single dispatching keeps you from specifying only that by, well, not actually dispatching to the method that you want to. So is there any way of solving that with in-language techniques? Well, the most usual way that you see this realized is with another feature that those languages might offer, like this introspection, which allows the to access the or to query the runtime type of a particular variable and act according to whatever occurs there during runtime. So in the Java world, you do that with this instance of test, basically. You could also simulate something like that by keeping some kind of numeric ID in your structs in a common place where you code whichever version of your thing you're carrying and then casting to the appropriate thing. But yeah, if you have it native to your language as a first or as a well main component of a language, then you get something like this instance of tests, and this is usually how you see these kinds of methods being written in your Java codes, for example. This would well work, of course, but burdens the programmer with type safety in terms of well getting this instance of tests right, and your compiler won't cry out in case that that you get something wrong, because well this is completely user specified. There's no compiler support for that. You might wonder whether you could do better. Also, of course, you need something like introspection, so you need to be able to query for types. So you might wonder whether you could do better by parameterizing the method with the actual type for which you want to determine the equality for. So this is something that you could do with for example, this equalizable, in our case, interface that can be parameterized with a type parameter. So you make use of what's known as generics and keep the parameter parameterizable. And in case that you provide such a natural, you might say that this implements equalizable on naturals. Thus, you instantiate the parameter here with the concrete natural, and this way you could argue that you could provide a well. Once again, there's this hash notion in there. Let's get rid of that. You could argue that you have such an equalizable aware set, so an implementation of the set that actually knows about this generic interface equalizable and depends on the parameter of that thing to be in given at instantiation time as natural, for example. Does that work? Well, does it not work? It's no exam. You can't be punished for your answer in that sense. Any idea whether that would work? Yeah?
I think in this case it can work, but you run into a problem when you have a class that inherits from natural, because it doesn't test it to the interface, but again, it's the same problem. It takes
So that is for sure an aspect that you will get with this type of solution to the problem. As soon as you start subtyping natural again, you run into the same problem as before. The other thing is, well, if you're used to this generics from the point of view of a C++ programmer, you might argue that this type parameter gets instantiated at compile time with a particular thing and be compiled down to something that actually has a concrete natural there and everything will work out. But that's not the way that Java generics work. Instead, they are Ah, I see the smile already. They are removed completely at compile time and instead replaced with typecasts and object as the things that are involved in that. So you will get this being compiled to or being tried to compile to a method that looks like equals object, and well, this gets a name clash with the original equals of object, and this also doesn't work with the way that generics internally are hardwired. So, bugger, that also doesn't work. Oh, well, yeah, the next question is somehow superfluous. But, so there's a technique out there. Oh, yeah?
But that's only a problem because we picked, like, the name equals, which is also one type of object. It's not a problem with the idea in general. Because if we name it equals, then you can
But I think the problem is also deep in the set where when it is programmed against an equalizable of parameter t, then in the implementation of the set also the type gets removed. But So what you can instead do is also a technique called double dispatching. So this now makes it a little bit more, it tries to make use of the single dispatching that is already in the language and tries to apply that on the first parameter or the first ordinary parameter of the function. And well, how you could do something like that is what you see over here. So you, instead of directly performing the equality check in the equals method, what you can do is you put that in a function that you place into a dispatch method of a dispatching object and use a general dispatching mechanism that is provided by the object given as parameter, which in case that the whole thing is another natural, will dispatch to the dispatching function that has the static type of this, which is another natural, meaning that it will dispatch to the natural instead of the object. Thus call the dispatching function that we have provided in there, which then will call the net number in that case. So that is a way that you can reach the comparison code with single dispatching measures, but in order to for that to really work, you of course need knowledge of all the involved components of that. Also, you need to have a double dispatch method being offered by all the components in the hierarchy on which you want this dispatcher to work. So maybe in the solution that you see over here, this is not a particularly well-suited implementation, but for settings where you have a known number of potential dispatching targets and this thing doesn't change anymore dynamically on during runtime, for example, you could work with a thing like this, and there's patterns that are based on this double dispatching technique that make use of visitor things and this double dispatching functions, and well, for some areas of application, this is quite a nice way of keeping concerns locally to one particular class, for example. But I think you will see an example for that in the tutorial. So, multiple dispatching. I see that my references need to be updated a little bit. Now, extends on the model that we have seen before for single dispatching by, instead of just dispatching on the receiver parameter, but instead dispatching also on the dynamic type of all the following parameters. So, how that could work in object-oriented languages would be to have specializers as subtype annotations to parameter types, for example, and offer variants of or candidates for dispatching that way, and have the automatically generated dispatcher selecting the most specific candidate. And that is something that can be added to mainstream languages quite nice. This works well with type checking, apart from, well, introducing further ambiguities between method call expressions and visible dispatching candidates. Code generation is quite nice insofar as the performance penalty that you pay for that kind of realization is only paid in case that there actually is multiple dispatching method in the system. If there is none, you don't pay any overhead. So that is something that has been done in the past for Java in the form of multi-Java in a research prototype, which introduced this notion of adding the subtype for which the multiply dispatched method would specialize as an annotation to the actual parameter. This would mean that you would dispatch based on a static type of object if the dynamic type is of type natural. So you get all that in this type expression in that sense, and with that be done with your implementation. So if you look behind the scenes, this was realized by having kind of an a usual sequence of if instructions in your bytecode. So you would have a kind of general dispatcher method introduced that does this dispatching here, and in the equals object you would have this dispatching code, which would then dispatch, for example, to the natural specialized version or to the generic object version. So yeah, however, this is a thing that is around since 15 or 20 years already. This hasn't made it into mainstream Java yet. However, there's other languages that have a native implementation of multi-dispatching. POSIX, for example. So there you can specify methods in this way, where you have several versions of this function fun, for example, specializing in their parameters, and if you later on call them, although the basic type is the common supertype, well, cool is the supertype for string and integer in Perl 6, you will get as dispatching target the one from this one over here, which is on int and string, which means these two actual values. And well, let's see how that whole system fares if we modify something like the foo is now blah and the bar is blah blah. So we have two strings in there. So this doesn't fit. this doesn't fit anymore, so everything that now is reachable is just this one where the two supertypes are reachable. So that is an implementation of multi-methods natively in the language. There's also other implementations. Another mainstream language, Clojure, a particular Lisp dialect for the JVM. This is particularly funny to read because people are not so used in this list-based specification of code, but everything or almost everything in there is presented as a list. Lists are always introduced with brackets, and the first element of each list kind of determines how this particular list has to be interpreted, and you can nest lists, so you can have hierarchical structures in that. And with that, you can provide program code, like the one over here, where you see there is multiple dispatching used, so you can introduce method name for multiple dispatching with this define multi, so this function name fun is now supposed to be multiply dispatched, and you can provide potential dispatching targets with this def method thing, so each of them contributes with its own potential dispatching target, and the code to be executed is given over there as a vector of parameters and, well, essentially a value that is considered to be the return value, because I was too lazy to provide an actual real longer code, but an return expression is already sufficient. And what is kind of special to this thing is the component that you see over here. This is meant to be the result of a so-called dispatching function, which is given to the multiple dispatched method at the declaration point of the multi-method. So the function given over here is determining how the dispatching should be done. So this is applied to the parameters. So the function over here was on two parameters, which you can also see over here. And it returns whatever is given over here. And you see that I was quite lazy and just directly threw everything that I got as parameter in my return vector. And in that sense, I just dispatch by the identity of the things that I get as parameters. But you can have arbitrary code in there, and thus you could, for example, have more sophisticated object structures, which would not just be simple keywords which have inheritance relation with each other, but more complex records, and could have expressions that evaluate the types of these records and based on this thing dispatched to the targets. But dispatching, particularly in this closure notion, is not just not just for dispatching based on types. You can have pretty arbitrary dispatching criteria, because you can just configure your dispatching method the way you like it. So in this example, this you see a little bit more of an elaborate situation where you have your multi-method called print and three candidates for printing, and depending on whatever this evaluation function gives you, you will have different dispatching targets. So I've just coded some silly code where you have a few persons from university that have a certain salary, so there's the ones from over here, and those objects go as parameters into the dispatching function over here, which is dispatching to salary's outcome. Salary then evaluates the wage of the person in question. So this salary only sees the actual value and splits between, well, whatever is given there is less than 600, more than 5,000, and everything in between. So it determines whether you're poor, rich, or average. And then, depending on your salary, it then gives these keywords back, which are then evaluated here at the as the dispatching basics, and then dispatching goes to the Hiwi for people with small income, the researcher for people with medium income, and professor for people with high income. So you can do pretty arbitrary funky stuff in that because you just have the full control on your dispatching method. So yeah, that's usually it. So multi-dispatching, that was a little pro and con. I'm not so big a fan of that, but you might be interested in what is seen as the of the as the pros and cons of each of these things. So pro is that, well, multi-dispatching is some kind of natural progression to just single dispatching. It's a generalization of an already well-known technique, directly solves practical problems like this double dispatching problem and eliminates this boilerplate code with this instance of things, and it's just in principle just compatible with common systems. However, this might be unintuitive since it counters this privileged first parameter or receiver parameter that is kind of an established principle out there. It imposes a little bit of runtime overhead, but just when it's actually really used. And you might see a few new exceptions when used with multiple inheritance, but you will see a little bit more on that in the tutorial. And well, of course, this most specific method thing is ambiguous, but it has already been ambiguous for method overloading before, so yeah. There's also other languages that I have not presented here that might offer things like multiple dispatching. You might look into Dylan or Scala for that thing, but also C#, I think, claims at least some notion of multiple dispatching, although I'm not so sure about whether that really fits that description, but here you go. Just a summary of what we have seen so far. So we've talked about dynamically dispatching on top of static dispatching, on top of overloading. We have seen single dispatching as it is in major object-oriented languages. We have looked a little bit in open source compilers. We have generalized this concept in to multi-dispatching and seen two languages where this actually is implemented. So, well, that's where my literature generation has gone amiss, but I think I'll correct that for the version that you find online. So thank you for your attention, and have a nice week.